They made this room bigger. Good evening. I'm Linda Black. I have anxiety and depression disorders. I was an inpatient at Ridgeview in August and September, coming up on 2 years ago. And that was not the first time I had problems with depression. I've been struggling with it off and on for 20, 25 years. My family tree looks like a depression orchard. It's just got, you know, ever limbs hung with somebody with depression, anxiety, alcoholism. My both grandmothers had ECT treatment when they were my age. So I came by it honestly, but I honestly don't care for it as a life choice, but it has handed me the opportunity to do and be and enjoy life in a way that I don't think I ever would have before. And it is kind of different for me to be here doing this First Friday speaker meeting, because usually it's been the people with addictions of different sorts that have been up here and have inspired me. And sometimes I think it's your program that's made it possible for me to stay in recovery from depression for much longer than I have since I was in my early 30s. And I'm a bit older than that now, but you don't get to know how much older than that. When I decided things had gotten bad enough to admit myself to Ridgeview, things were pretty well on the old rock bottom, as we say. And I've since found a theme song for that first day in Ridgeview, and I'd like to share it with you. Why, but I think all of us can sympathize with his opening here. We'll get back to him in a minute. Because I don't want to waste too much of my time. I have my little stack of things here. In my recovery, one of the primary things I've done has been read. I have read the AA Big Book, the EA Big Book. I've read most of Harry Potter. I've read some inspirational literature. I've read some of the great classics, To Kill a Mockingbird most recently. And, Caroline, where are you? Life-changing. You're just so right. Before I get on with that, I'd like to start with a prayer. Y'all all join me. Dear God, bless this telling of my story so that I may feel present and grateful for the life you have given me. May this telling speak to this dear audience in a way that is useful. May in the telling and the listening we find some of our own truth. May the telling be transparent and the listening be generous. May the God of each of our understanding use this telling to transform our wounds into portals of entry for the pure, clear light of our true selves and your love for us. In Jesus' name, amen. One of the books I read was a book called Gilead, and it's a story about a Presbyterian minister in a rural Midwestern state who had been single for most of his life. And then when he was in his mid-50s, fell in love and married a much younger woman. And as the book opens, he is in the final stages of his life with a 6-year-old son, but he's still preaching. And he's watching his son and his little friend play in the yard. And that's where we're going to join them tonight. The little boy's friend's name is Tobias, and you never learn his son's name. You and Tobias are hopping around in the sprinkler. The sprinkler is a magnificent invention because it exposes raindrops to sunshine. That does not occur in nature. That does occur in nature, but it is rare. Well, but you two are dancing around in your iridescent little downpour, hooping and stomping as sane people ought to do when they experience a thing so marvelous as water. And I've loved that, and I couldn't put my finger on why. And when I was getting ready for this talk, I realized that recovery has a lot in common with a sprinkler. And I'm going to work on developing that idea tonight. So this evening, this speaker's meeting, it gives me a chance to share for all who embrace it that no matter what your problem is or you think it is, the 12 steps in the program of AA provide a way of life that is happy, joyous, and free. Not just depression or anxiety, but life, managed, just putting up with depression and anxiety. I think a lot of us do that. We think if we can just get through the day and chug along, we've got our depression under control. Well, I heard somebody say that you could live joyous, happy, and free, and I was like, that's what I want. I don't want to just drag through this. I don't want life in neutral. I don't want tolerant. I want exuberant. And I started watching the people in the program that had a good program, and George finds it some mystery as to why I tagged along. But I picked out George Mize early on as a man with a great program who was a very spiritual man who I would follow and help me find life exuberant and spiritual and joyous and happy and free. And he's helped me learn that, and for that I'm forever grateful. Thank you. So tonight we're going to learn the mechanisms of stomping and dancing in a thing so marvelous as life. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. That's the big book, page 58. Tonight I will tell you some of how I used to be and how I got the way I was the day I showed up at Ridgeview and what's happened since then, and hopefully I'll stay within the 37 minutes left. My math's a little challenged. So let me tell you a story. I was born the second child of a brilliant and ambitious mother, a homemaker, and a veteran of 51 missions over World War II Germany. We lived on a farm 3 miles off of the nearest blacktop and $30,000 in debt when I was born, as I learned from my mother and heard repeatedly for the next 26 years. My mother has a history of an abusive father and grandmother. Her grandmother said God owed her 12 blessings, and he sent 12 boys, and he owed her one beating, and he sent her a girl. She sort of had a thing about guys. My mother had some sexual abuse at the hands of a neighbor. Her mother had 2 or 3 ECT treatments while she was about 50. My daddy was orphaned when his father died of appendicitis when he was 4 years old. And he was given to his aunt to raise. You didn't adopt children. They just kind of handed them around. And he got moved from family to family until he joined the military. His mother also had ECT treatment in her mid-50s. When I was born, I was, as I said, the second child, and things were really bad. We were in debt. Things were difficult. My mother and father had recurring vicious arguments, and I don't know, you know, I was a baby. Was it a fight? Was it an argument? It all sounded really bad to me. I was told repeatedly by my mother that the one time my dad actually tried to act on his threats to kill her was when she was holding me in her arms when I was 2 weeks old. And she always told me that if it hadn't have been for me, Daddy would have killed her. And I took up that banner and spent the next 18 years in my role of a mute observer of these fights. And wherever I was when they started, I would move to the room they were in and stand there until they were done. And I heard every vicious thing they'd said. I saw every vein pop out on my dad's neck. I saw his hands go up to her neck so many times and him threatening to rip her head off and throw it out to the dogs. I heard so many violent threats, but they never materialized. But I was prepared. Every time they'd start, I'd walk through the house. I'd locate the shotgun. I'd locate the bullets. I knew how to load it. I knew how to shoot it. And I knew that I could kill him if he tried. And I never wavered in my confidence on that. When they were done, I would talk to my mother and see if I could help her feel better. And then I'd go out in the yard and talk to my dad and see if he could feel better. Neither one of them ever took any of my advice. You know, I just was very persistent with trying to keep them from killing each other. Some of their fights lasted for 30 minutes, and some of them lasted for 3 or 4 hours. These continued until I left home and went to college. I'm sure they continued after I left, but I wasn't there to hear them. During these fights, God was my nearest and dearest companion. He and I spoke extensively. Out in front of our little farmhouse, there was a pasture gate that you could see the house, but you were out in the dark. And I'd stand out at that gate and cry, talk to God about why this had to happen. And I always felt like I had a friend. There were 4 kids in our family, 2 sisters, one 2 years older and one 7 years younger. And my brother was 4 years younger than myself. The 4 of us never discussed the fights. We did farm work, we grew a garden, we herded cows, we raised calves, we baled and hauled hay, we picked cucumbers. By the time I was 6 years old, I could bulldog a small calf, throw him down, tie him up, brand him, and castrate him. And as I told my friend, in a pair of tennis shoes, because we couldn't afford cowboy boots. So don't mess with me, boys. We had this fabulous swimming hole in the creek. My dad had dug it out with a steam shovel he rented. And so we would, you know, that was the thing. You finished running the cows in the morning, you were really sweaty and hot, you ran through the creek, got wet. That was your air conditioning system because you went to the field then and picked cucumbers. And as you dried out, you had personalized air conditioning. You had finished picking cucumbers for lunch. You went down, hopped in the creek, got back out. It was great. You only had the downside was you had to circle the swimming hole once or twice to make sure there weren't any water moccasins. And if they were clear, then you were ready to roll. Now, the one thing about swimming was a recurrent problem my mother had was that she was quite determined that we would be ambitious. And so before you could play, you had to swim 10 laps of the American crawl. You had to do 10 rounds on the kickboard. You had to do the breaststroke and the backstroke and some other one, probably the butterfly. My sister eventually swam on a competitive swimming team. I never quite got to that athletic achievement thing, but it just generally pissed me off that I had to do all that. But I did it, and eventually, this has been the curse of my life. I can do almost anything that I absolutely hate really well. And so people go, oh, you're so good at that. And I'm like, oh, I just hate it. So this will come back. You'll remember that piece. In school, I was not particularly popular. I went to school in rural Northwest Red River Parish. People didn't really value school. You endured it. I graduated with a class of 18. I was the only girl in the class, wasn't pregnant the night we graduated. And that was probably because my mother contained me so severely. Otherwise, I think my innate, exuberant, slightly flirtatious personality, I would have been with the rest of the crowd. But my mother never let me go anywhere unescorted, so I wasn't pregnant. But anyway, as a teenager, I was about 90 pounds. I sort of had a silhouette of hairdo, tennis shoes, knee pads, nothing else. So I wasn't particularly the cool chick with the guys. I had this intense crush on this dude named Pete Duell, and he was the star of Alias Smith and Jones, and was he cute? And I just drooled over him. I never told anybody. That was my own private secret. And right here, I have my first slump into depression, because in 1971, Pete Duell committed suicide. And he was my confidant. I talked to him out at the gate, him and God. I knew that if he read one of my letters, he was going to come and get me and take me out of that horrible situation. And when he died, I knew I was stuck. And I must have cried over that man for 2 years. Never did anybody know it, always by myself. But my first true love committed suicide and left me to more observing of the torrential arguments. I was good in school, made A's. I did a lot of things, had a lot of accomplishments. I was really good at stuff, but not like a natural. Nothing came easy. I had to practice everything. Effort, tenacity, and endurance are my strengths and my curses. I practiced piano 3, maybe 4 hours a day. I got good enough to be invited to play at the New Orleans Philharmonic Symphony youth auditions. I didn't win, but I got all the way through the piece, and 2 weeks later, I'd forgotten it. It was great. I would have preferred to have done ballet or sing, but my mother thought ballet was heathen, and singing meant I was showing off, which I probably was, but so what? So Mama was really critical of stuff she didn't approve of, and I took a lot of feedback on my behavior around men. You know, I was either showing my ass, trying to get their attention, being a flirt, ruining my reputation, batting my eyes. Let's see what else. Any girls want to contribute to that line of comments? Anyhow, you know, there was no way in hell she was ever going to learn if I liked a guy or not, because she would just embarrass you so badly and make you feel just like, oh, my God. I remember I was probably 14. I decided that women should have been made like Barbie doll, just with legs that connected to their bodies so that your mother couldn't talk about your genitalia, because that was just the worst, you know. Anyhow. Probably should have made guys that way, too, but that's another story. All right, so this is a pattern of my early years. The details kind of repeat themselves. I was fairly accomplished. I won this is great for a girl that wanted to be a cheerleader. Loved makeup, loved ruffles, loved to flirt. I was the Louisiana state champion in agriculture. Had to do with bulldogging those cows when I was real little. But anyway, I got to go to Chicago. I wore a bright red suit. I ran into this really cute guy from Kansas. My mother wasn't there. He thought I was great. I thought he was great. He came to visit me in northwest Louisiana, and that was the last I saw him. I did pretty good. I interpreted life through my mother, you know, because what I wanted was always wrong, so obviously I had a basic defect that I had to work on all the time. And what Mama wanted me to do, I saw as right, because in spite of all the things I've said about her, I adored my mother. She was the beginning and end of all of my life. I would do anything for her. I would not leave her at night because I was afraid Daddy was going to kill her. I never spent the night away from home until I went to college. She was intelligent. She read poetry. She helped me with sewing projects. She helped me with school. I got god-awful poison ivy all the time. She sat up with me at night and rubbed liniment ointments on it and stuff. She was a grand, intelligent, accomplished woman, and I would do nothing to disappoint her. So what I eventually developed was a very well-honed self that was what she wanted. And I could convince myself that what she suggested was the best thing for me, and that I actually wanted to do that, even though I didn't think I wanted to do that. I could talk myself into it and be pretty convincing that that was exactly what I wanted to do. And so you can see that's a fairly contorted way to develop an ego, with that sort of distortion going round and round. So, summary, since I've been in research in my older years, I lived a life like a well-trained lab rat on an electric grid. You know, I could about get it right, and then it was always anxiety-producing. But the other thing about my mother was she was creepy about men. Just eat. Because you would, you know, like I remember when I was 4 or 5, I had this cousin. He was maybe 14. I don't remember. I only saw him once or twice. But he picked me up off the hay wagon. I was, like I said, 4 or 5. And he put me on his shoulders and carried me around the yard. And he was singing. And he put me down on the porch. And he, you know, he went on off. And my mother says, "How dare you lead that boy on?" And I'm looking at him. And she says, "He was just rubbing your pussy on his neck." And you know, when you're 4 or 5 years old, you're like going, "My what? My what? What is that?" So, you know, the men were never to be trusted until they nailed the lid on the coffin. There was this. I'm just telling you what my mother said. You know, guys were always going to drag you out behind the barn and pull your pants down. And, you know, funny thing was how reluctant I was to absorb this stuff, because I continued through my entire life to be one of the most incorrigible flirts known to man. You know, and maybe it's reactive or whatever, but, you know, the minute I got out of her sight, you know, I went to the hamburger joint with my 10 best friends who were all guys. I was on top of the world. You know, I went to medical school because the ratio was ideal. There was my class had 100 people in it. There were 90 men, 10 women. I liked this. This was good. So anyway, my mother kind of freaked me out. It's a wonder I'm not frigid and transsexual or something. But college was great. There were all these guys. I was good at school. I could play tennis. You can wear really short dresses. So things got better. The electric grid was a little in the distance. I had to go home on the weekends sometimes. But oh, you know, a really weird story. My sister and I shared a room when we were growing up. We shared a bed. There was only the farmhouse had 3 bedrooms. A living room, a kitchen, and a little bathroom in the middle. So it's a circular thing. And the bathroom was because my mother threw a real health fit about it because Daddy thought an outdoor toilet was a good idea. But anyway, so we had indoor plumbing, which was cool. But when my sister and I left, we left home together. She was 20. She'd been in college 2 years. I was 18. I got away 2 years ahead of her. But we were setting up our apartment. It was a 2-bedroom, 1 living room, 1 bath apartment. And I was like, "Yes, my own room." My sister says, "Let's turn that one into a study so we can be quiet study, and then we'll share this bedroom." Well, I negotiated back to we can share the bedroom, but we are not sleeping in the same damn bed. She wanted us to keep sleeping together. It's like, well, we've always done it, but Cindy, you're 20 years old. So anyhow, I did get my own bed. Anyhow, I finished college in 2 years and 3 months. It was a program that somebody in Louisiana thought was a good idea, where you took these rural country kids and you got some that were relatively skilled, and you've got them through college and medical school in 6 years, and it was an approach to get rural kids back out to the farm to be doctors in rural Louisiana. Well, the little detail they forgot was that when you get a country girl out of the country, she is not going back. So, you know, here I am in Atlanta. And Northwest Louisiana still doesn't have enough doctors. I had a first husband. And he seemed like a good idea at the time. I honestly, this was like, you know, I thought I had bad judgment about men because I always dated kind of badass guys that were any pretty entertaining, but they weren't real faithful. And so this guy was really nice, and he was really Christian, and he was, anyway, I thought God was saying, Linda, this is a good choice. There are fake God voices. You have to beware of those. They really are. But anyway, he was brilliant, outstandingly brilliant, sarcastic, moody, strangely volatile, in fits of rage. He could rip a limb off a tree with no trouble. And he had this victim thing. I always had to protect and defend him. Now, you know, I was, at that time, I was still rather petite. And, you know, he would get in trouble with one of his partners, and he was a doctor. He's an anesthesiologist. And, you know, I would go tell the surgeon off for picking on the husband. You know, and it's like, wonder why that needs to embarrass the hell out of him. My wife has to go tell this guy out. Anyway, I didn't think it was weird until I got out of it. But I spent a lot of time protecting him.
Microphone.
Sorry. But I had my first tension headache ever in my second year of medical school. Before that, I didn't know what headache was. And it was my constant companion for the next 10 or 12 years. I thought I had a brain tumor that was just slow growing, because they did the MRI and all that stuff looking for it. But anyhow, that was about the time I started having issues with depression. And then I had a C6, C7 cervical fusion that was compliments of Jane Fonda, because I wasn't as limber as she was, and I tried to do her exercise routine. And so at that point, my mother disowned me because I had the surgery against her wishes. I was a 32-year-old physician. She was still my mother, and she said, I told you not to do that, so, you know, you're out of the will. But anyhow, during the time of my divorce, I made up for some lost time on my social life. Dated lots of guys, some of them good for me, some of them not so good for me. And then met and married my current husband, who is a total dear. And we've been married 20 years. At the time, people said, I can't believe you're marrying that guy. I can't believe you're marrying that guy. You realize he's a high school dropout. I'm like, yeah. Y'all aren't matched. Well, I said, yeah, I know that. I wasn't very open to suggestion. And, you know, it turned out to be one of the best choices in my life. So I kind of have a sort of a jaundiced view of what people generally think is a good way to make a decision, because the one I made really heavily weighed and thought out and all that was really bad. And the one I made, because it felt just like the funnest, most amazing thing I could think of to do, was really good. So anyhow, I have that. But since medical school and my early years as a pediatrician, I've had depression issues off and on. I think some of it has to do with my history, my background. Some of it has to do with the fact that I had a artificial self-ego, self-image. It was actually my mother's image. I always loved the little thing about what is a codependent see right before they die. And somebody else's life flashes before their eyes. I, I sort of understood that. Now, in dealing with depression, I have had outpatient treatment. I have taken medications. I have been in support groups, individual therapy, hypnotherapy, Vedic astrology readings, Chinese herbs, all sorts of yoga, exercise, physical therapy, acupuncture. I've had 12 different jobs in 20 years. I've tried every angle I can think of to get rid of the depression and to find a fulfilling and satisfying life. I thought it was because I was in the wrong profession, because I picked going to medical school because there were plenty of guys, instead of the fact that I really wanted to take care of people, although I'm really good at taking care of people. But remember what I told you about. I can be really good at something that I don't really like that much. So it sort of fakes people out. It's not that good of a thing, actually. But I was always, always searching for something fulfilling, something rewarding, something important, something that mattered. And it just never came to be. So in this search, I developed this cyclic pattern of, I get this great idea, like I decided when I was in my mid-40s I was going to be a neonatologist. And that's really old to take that on, because that's like every third night call and up all weekend and no sleep. And I was at that time in a pediatric practice where I got one night of call every 17, 18 days and one weekend every 3 months. So I wasn't happy with that. I went back to every third night call and every other weekend and just wrenching trauma, high disaster. But I became motivated. I was determined. I was in there. I was making outstanding results. I came to Emory. I was the director of the fellowship program. I was starting a research lab in neuroelectrophysiology. I had funding. I ran a semester-long course in academic excellence for the residents and fellows. And at the end of that, I left work for 6 weeks with a really severe depression. I was at the top of my game. I was doing great, and I was just bawling my eyes out all the time. Just couldn't concentrate. It was really, and so I thought, okay, I'm just tired. So I got tired. I took 6 weeks off. I loved that. Oh, doing nothing was great. I started reading Harry Potter. It's great. I went back to work and did a little halftime. Then I went back on the unit, which is running the intensive care nursery. You oversee 3 residents, 30 babies, 160 nurses, labor and delivery, intensive care, resuscitations, procedures. And I was doing okay, but one day I realized I couldn't remember which baby's labs went with which baby. And I was like, this is weird. I don't ever do this. And gradually, I got to where I was realizing I was mixing up the babies and the parents. And that was quite frightening. And I kept telling my boss, my brain's not working right. And I was getting scared. And prior to that, scared had not been in my vocabulary. I am as brave as a bull. I just don't, nothing bothers me. I can stand up to a 6'8" guy and tell him, you sit your butt down there because we're going to do this to your kid, and I don't care what you think, and I'll get security to come get you if you don't like it. But I was getting scared, and I showed up in a delivery and a resuscitation of a very, very sick baby, and I froze. I didn't know what to do next, and I do know what to do next. And I was like, something's bad wrong here. And it sort of progressed from there. My boss made all sorts of rearrangements because she said, oh, Linda, it's just your depression. You know, stay at this. Work at it a little harder. Well, working at it harder, I got scareder and I got more anxious. And the anxiety spread, and I got to where I was scared to walk down the steps of my house. I thought I was going to trip and kill myself. I was scared to walk down the sidewalk, because a car was going to run off the sidewalk and kill me. My husband was going to cut his arm off with a knife because he was cutting potatoes in the kitchen. it was just like I got nuts. I didn't know what was going on. It wasn't me. It wasn't anything. It didn't make sense. I cried all the time. And then I started having thoughts about this ain't worth it. I can't live like this. I can't do this anymore. And then I started imagining how I might get out of it. And that was kind of my, okay, this ain't right. This is just not me. So I only got to suicidal ideation before I decided to come into Ridgeview. But it was so much below my baseline. So that was how I got here. And I was probably the happiest new patient Ridgeview's ever had. I was like, this is great. There's nobody here cares that I'm like nuts as hell. They're glad to see me. Everybody's hugging me. I can just relax. I was so happy to see that. Oh, what was her name that ran the women's halfway house? Eleanor. I loved Eleanor. She just bossed me around. I said, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. So, I don't think anybody's ever been as thrilled to be in protective custody as I was. So I took this place really seriously. I was working hard at it. I was showing them all of my bad sides. I was obnoxious sometimes. I tell this one guy in our group, it was like, if you're not serious about this shit, you can leave because we're tired of you. And he looked at me, and the next day he was gone. I thought if I'd have known telling people off worked that well, I'd have started it a lot sooner. But it got to where I was content here. I was glad to be here from the very minute I got here. And then there were these people wanted to talk about a program. What the hell is a program? Everybody kept talking about working steps. Well, I can step. You don't have to work at this. And I was really confused because it was just like this inherent vocabulary that was in this place. And I didn't know what people were talking about. And they were somewhat unaware of my lack of knowledge here. And so I started paying pretty close attention. And at first I thought, I don't need this stuff. I don't have addiction. I don't have a problem with that. They really got me in the wrong group. Why do they want me to keep going to these meetings? They're just, wine. So I sort of, went reluctantly. But there started to be little pieces of it that made sense to me. And I gradually became aware that there was a lot that made sense to me. And, the whole of we admitted we were powerless over our emotions. Now, that's the EA thing. Well, that's just real true, because these emotions get hold of you and they just rip you one way and then the other, and it makes no sense, and you want to do something and your brain keeps going round and round and you can't make them stop. I finally realized that, yes, indeed, they just had me hook, line, and sinker, and that was right. I was powerless over my emotions. And then the second step came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I had trouble with that, too, because, I had grown up Methodist, and I was quite involved in the church, and, like I told you, me and God were buds from early on, because he and I were out there at that gate when Mom and Daddy were fighting, and so I started getting down on my knees in my little bunk bed at night and praying, and I thought they kind of hit the ceiling, and I'd look at my roommate, and she looked pretty serious about her prayers, so I'd keep praying. And then one day my group leader said, Linda, I want you to ask for awareness of God's presence. And so I started asking for that, but honestly, it didn't really work much better. And then this is one of my first encounters with George. He was talking about centered prayer, and he wrote it on a little napkin for me. I was going to count to 20 and relax, and then I was going to imagine something spiritual and count to 20 while I thought about that, and then I was going to be quiet and listen for God. And I was about as optimistic about that working as I was the rest of things working. But so I got in my living room, and I took my deep breaths, and I got all calm, and I counted to 20, and I thought of some, what's spiritual? And so I thought of this little blue rowboat. You can't see it, but that's my little blue rowboat. He stays with me now. And I asked God to be with me, and I started breathing and thinking about God, and I never opened my eyes to know if this was true, but as I was praying, I felt presences with me, and I could picture angels in my living room, and they weren't just ordinary, glowing, gorgeous angels. They were kind of ordinary, sloppy angels, with baggy wings and a t-shirt and some jeans, and you know, they'd all gone by the kitchen and gotten coffee and were kind of lounging, and I just had this sense of peace and support, and I was thinking, I'm not gonna move. I got all these angels, and you know, they've been with me ever since, and when I close my eyes and start to pray, they all show back up. And I just love these guys. And so they're part of life. And I thought, you know, maybe there is something to this spirituality and God can return us to sanity. And then there is step three of turned our will and our lives over to God as we understood him. Well, I had already done this. I was so excited. I didn't know there were steps. I didn't know there were 12. I didn't know what they said. But the day I decided to go into Ridgeview, I was so scared at home by myself. I couldn't figure out what to do because I had to call and tell them I wanted the bed. And so I got down on my knees by my bed in my bedroom, and I started talking to God. And ever so often I'd say, you know, when you and I get finished talking here, when I stand up, I'm going to go call them. I'm going to go call Ridgeview. And so that took me about an hour, and I finally stood up, and I went and called Ridgeview and said, I want that bed. And so I think I turned my will and my life over to God that day, and he's carried me ever since. So step three kind of got out of order. I got a little creative with it. But we are at 8:58. I have since done a lot of work on the steps. I've been to a lot of meetings. I took them seriously. As a psych patient coming out of Ridgeview, I came really close to 90 meetings in 90 days. Not quite as close, but I have continued in group therapy. I go to 2 groups a week. I go to 3 meetings a week. I see my therapist twice a week. I have never faltered on my medication. They knew what they were talking about. And I can honestly say that I have relationships that are valuable to me. I have people that know me like nobody's known me before, and they come and they care for me. I have a relationship with my husband that was better than it was been. And I can honestly say it's been a long time, about a year and 8 months, since I was really depressed. I've hit some slumps. I've hit some down times, but they don't last long. And I do the stuff they talk about in the program. I call my sponsor. I say a prayer. I got a little list, again, thanks to George, up over my desk that says, you know, write your gratitude list, say a prayer. If that doesn't work, call me. And, you know, it works for emotional disorders. It's just no doubt in my mind. And it's been the biggest life-changing thing I've ever experienced. And I really owe it all to you guys for including me and for taking care of me. Thank you.